Last year, Turner Stokes presented a sermon in which he summarized his message by saying, "What you see is what you get." While that might be a strong and pithy statement, I found that I couldn't agree with it. Nevertheless, his sermon accomplished one thing that every sermon ought to do. It made me think. So, with all due respect to Turner's views, I would like to offer mine as a sort of a counterpoint to his. I hope that I can also make you think and perhaps feel something as well. As I have said in other sermons, my faith has to answer to my head and to my heart. The tenets of my faith must match the facts as we best understand them. I also need my faith to stir my heart and comfort it from time to time. A faith that does only one or the other is incomplete for me. One of the elements necessary for the heart dimension is a sense of mystery or wonder. Anyone who is sufficiently aware of the beauty and the grandeur of the universe that surrounds us must necessarily stand in awe from time to time. In our congregational mission statement, we describe ourselves as lifelong learners. This learning would apply to the lessons of science and to the lessons of faith. My topic is how science and reason intersect with faith. My thesis is that when faith is approached in the proper way, reason and science reinforce faith rather than contradict it. I also believe that reason and science alone cannot provide a substitute for faith. It's not hard to find people who are convinced that a proper understanding of science precludes the practice of faith. You may have noticed the insert in your order of service that shows various scientists' views on science and religion. When you read them, preferably after the sermon, you will find that they are all over the map. The only thing they share is their level of certitude. Now, if you believe that you must refer to the Bible as a science textbook, and if you interpret Genesis to mean six 24-hour periods passed before God rested, then there is an irreconcilable conflict between science and your religion. If, however, you read the Bible for its beauty and its wisdom, then the two can coexist. One of the reasons I believe that people referred to earlier are mistaken is because I don't think they understand how science can provoke a sense of awe and wonder in scientists and laymen alike. The more we understand about the universe, the more fascinating it becomes. Secondly, they probably don't realize that many people of faith have no need for the supernatural. Many of us can have a rich, coherent, and rewarding faith without it. I, for one, don't believe in miracles, but I find it self-evident that we're surrounded by marvels. Some people seem to believe that faith requires mystery, a conviction that God is in the unknowable. They seem to think that every time a mystery is solved, the case for faith and the need for faith is diminished. Eventually, they say, we will have enough answers that faith and religion are no longer required. Actually, I don't think we need to worry about running out of mystery. As the British geneticist J.B.S. Haldane put it, I have no doubt that in reality the future will be vastly more surprising than anything I can imagine. Now, my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. For me, whenever science does solve a mystery, it's replaced by a marvel. I find no net loss of awe and wonder. Sometimes the answer is more striking than the mystery. Think of what it must have been like in 1953 when Crick and Watson introduced us to the wonders of DNA. Somehow, a twisted helix of paired nucleotides carries all of the information necessary to create and operate the genetic code of a human being. And subtle differences are all it takes to distinguish us from our chimpanzee cousins. I'm sure you've heard that our DNA and a chimp's is 98% the same. Earlier, excuse me again, I said that the wonders of science reinforce the sense of wonder and awe that I find essential to my faith. I would like to dwell for a few moments on one phenomenon to explain more fully what I mean. Back in 1977, some geologists were working in a deep-sea submersible 5,000 feet below the surface. They were researching underwater volcanic vents, places where the heat and the chemicals from the magma core find their way to the bottom of the seabed. They were astonished to find a thriving habitat of life forms previously unknown to science. The most striking feature was a species of tube worms approximately 8 feet long. They were surrounded by specially adapted mollusks, shrimps, and crabs. It was eventually determined that the adult tube worms have no mouths and no gut. They live on a symbiotic relationship with the bacteria that live inside them. At this depth, the pressure on these life forms is at least 2,000 pounds per square inch. In a world surrounded by intense cold, the temperatures are nearly at the boiling point. Since there is no light at these depths, the food chain is not based on green plants, but rather on the bacteria which thrive on the sulfuric acid and other chemicals spewing out of the vents. Last year, similar colonies were found near vents in the Antarctic Ocean. These communities don't include the tube worms, but they do feature a species of octopus, a seven-armed sea star, and a crab known as a Yeti crab, which grows colonies of bacteria on its rough, oversized pincers. It literally uses its body to farm bacteria. The extremity of these conditions and the rich complexity of the ecological relationships have been cited by astronomers as supporting evidence of the possibility of life on other planets. Now, at the risk of sounding like the child of the 60s that I am, the more I learn about this one isolated discovery, the more it blows my mind. The mere fact that life can survive and thrive in those conditions speaks volumes to me about the indomitability of life and the infinite creativity that life can demonstrate. It inspires a sense of humility worthy of a medieval monk. Now, let me hasten to recognize that the word humility may stir bad memories for some of you. In many traditions, in order to demonstrate humility, it was necessary to debase oneself. I don't see any conflict between our first principle and this brand of humility. It is perfectly possible to be overwhelmed by the scope and beauty of the universe without thinking any less of oneself. My worth and my dignity are not diminished by my surroundings. Science can do more than inspire awe. It can teach us lessons that reinforce our principles. The most obvious would be the relationship between ecology and our seventh principle. The more we learn about life in this universe that we have been given, the more we are compelled to do our duty to use it wisely and to serve as its stewards. For all the wonder that knowledge of the universe can invoke, and for all the lessons that it can teach us, there is more about faith that operates on a different plane. Awe and wonder are not the sum total of a fully developed faith. Faith and religion have essential elements that reason and science cannot provide, and we should not expect them to. Charles Darwin showed us how our species came to be here, and my parents explained to me how I came to be here, but neither explanation addresses why. They do nothing to explain what my life is for or whether I'm using it wisely. Faith provides the so what behind the facts that we absorb. My Methodist parents tried to teach us some of these lessons, and they unwittingly modeled some others, both good and bad. Eventually, I had to build my own set of ideas, and some of which I chose to bring with me and some of which I had to leave behind. The purpose that I find in my life comes partly from my upbringing and partly from my own observations and considerations. Knowledge and meaning are not the same. We have all heard the line about the man who knew the price of everything and the value of nothing. Also, most of the facts that surround us don't change, and human nature doesn't seem to change, but our understanding of them can and should. If we live with our eyes open and give some thought to what we see, our understanding should mature and deepen. Like a tree that never moves from one spot, we can continue to grow and expand our wisdom. We can rationally observe that a certain level of cooperation with our neighbors enhances our chances of survival. The first humans gathered in tribes to divide tasks and to defer attacks from animals and other tribes. Today, we form neighborhood associations, political parties, and nation states to provide for the common defense and to secure the blessings of liberty. That sort of mutually beneficial behavior does not explain why some people of faith feel compelled to go well beyond mutual support to a lifetime of service. Whatever it is that drives people in this direction, it is unlikely that it can be fully explained. The odds are that each of us in this room feels that impulse from one time or another, and to one extent or another, and we would be hard-pressed to explain it to ourselves, let alone to anyone else. One corollary that interests me. Some people look at the state of scientific knowledge today and contend that there is no place for God. God is not required for the information to hold together. Others, who are equally intelligent and not the least bit superstitious, see the brilliance with which the universe is stitched together and see a designer's hand. They contend that the system is too cunningly interconnected for it to have fallen together by accident. For me, the case for a designer is well-founded, but ultimately not convincing. Some listen to their case and heap scorn on it. I respect their views even when I don't share them. The designer contingent bring too much to the argument for us to be dismissive or condescending. In the end, though, that question is not particularly important to me. I can appreciate the wonders of nature regardless of how they came to be. How they happened doesn't tell me anything about how to lead my life or what's important in it. Now, surely, some of you are thinking that if there really is a designer, he may want me to lead my life doing his will rather than my own. I don't know if there is a God or not, but I am utterly convinced that God does not tinker with his creation. How I came to that conclusion could probably be a sermon in itself. I just thought I would explain why the question of the designer is not an important issue for me, while it can be so crucial to someone else. So to summarize, my faith has to address my heart and my head. Science and reason teach my head and provide some lessons with obvious spiritual implications. And the marvels of nature touch my heart, but there is much more to my faith. With respect, what we get is more than what we can see. With a proper approach to faith and reason, we can have it all. We can indulge our fascination with the material world as we understand it, while we develop our faith in a separate dimension. I am confident that the next big science discovery will only enhance my faith and not diminish it.